This is Greg Pierce from UCLA, and you're listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations: by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference; by 120 Water, new rules need new tools; by Advanced Drainage Systems, our reason is water; by 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience; by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services; by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow; by Xylem, let's solve water; and by the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource. This is session 268.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGimsey.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey, and thank you so much for joining me. And thank you as always for your support over the last 10 plus years. Today's guest is Alex Shannon, a Senior Vice President and Western Region Business Line Leader for WSP. Alex takes us on a journey looking at water from a variety of perspectives as an economist, a capital planner, and more. And he does a great job identifying issues and providing examples of what he's seen work in the water sector. So stay tuned for a great interview by Alex. But before we get to that, as you know, we always say thank you to our fantastic sponsors at the top of the show. And we have some fantastic sponsors, including Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Water Works Association. And that, my friends, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education. And I thank you all. And I'd like for you, the listener, to please do me a favor. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks will go. And as long as you're letting the sponsors know how much you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It's an easy way to say you appreciate the podcast, and it helps others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Well, now it's time for the main event, our interview with Alex Shannon. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Alex, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How are you doing today?
Dave, I am so good. Thank you for having me on the Water Values Podcast. Actually, for my inaugural podcast debut here. This is my first, and I'm really excited that this is the first podcast that I get to do because I've been an admirer for a while, and I think the exploration that you do here is really cool.
Well, thank you very much. And for the listeners out there, Alex was not paid to say that. Alex, could you give us a little background on who you are, how you came to the water sector?
Yeah, for sure. So I started my career in something totally different than engineering, kind of like yourself. And my degrees are in economics, and I actually went into corporate finance for a hot second and realized that that was not for me. I wanted to be a creative problem solver. I come from a long line of engineers that have been working in the water space for a long time. And so I had written my thesis on the economics of a risk of a dam failure, and found myself a job as an entry-level economist working on big water and wastewater program delivery and water resource economics at CH2M Hill, which then became Jacobs. And I then ended up at HDR, building out a national practice in that water economics consulting space, before coming over to WSP. And here I am now, suddenly found myself leading a team of about 200 people with a large water, wastewater, and water resources business. And I'm having the absolute time of my life.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's what the water sector will give you. You know, it'll give you the time of your life. So can you, I'm curious, building out the water economics platform for a company, what are clients looking for in a water economics? I mean, what are the services that a water economics platform is providing?
Yeah, it's not something that that I thought existed as a career when I was in college. Nobody was like, "Do you want to be a water resource economist?" And it just wasn't really like a career path you could take. I kind of sometimes look back and marvel at like, "Wow, how did I get here?" But clients, you know, are increasingly trying to do more with less. They're trying to use data to make the smartest, most optimal decisions that they can make to benefit their communities, but also to invest heavily into our water infrastructure, which is very much needed. And so, you know, economics is all about how you manage scarcity. And so I think it ties really well with water, because water is a scarce resource. It is something that we have to manage really wisely. Pair that with the fact that we have, you know, affordability challenges across the country, and we need to manage our community financial resources in the best way possible. It just sort of made sense that we bring economics into water infrastructure. And so it's really about making those smart investment decisions into infrastructure with the most best up-to-date information that we can.
So in your experience, how do you go about doing that? What's the best way to bring that economic way of thinking to water infrastructure investment?
Yeah, I'll put on my technical hat for a minute, and I love modeling. not a hydraulic modeler by any means, but I think that we have so much cool technology at our fingertips these days. And so one of the passion projects of mine over my career has been trying to create more dynamic master plans and dynamic capital improvement plans, because we will go in and work with utilities across the country to develop a 30-year look ahead on what they need to do in their drinking water, wastewater, or stormwater utility. And I don't know about you, but I don't know what I'm doing next week, let alone 30 years from now. And it's so hard to capture all of the variables that you need to capture and then decide 30 years from now, my climate is going to look like X, my population growth is going to look like Y, the condition of my assets are going to look like Z. And to say, okay, that's it, that's the plan. And then the big question becomes, what do we do if something changes? And how do we react to that? And so my career has been trying to build models that allow you to dynamically adjust your CIP based on a bunch of different factors, whether your finances change, whether your project priorities change, whether your growth projections are different than you thought they would be. We need to be able to go back and say, this master plan is not going to just be collecting dust. We can just go into a tool like that and say, let's tweak it. Let's move this project out. Let's pull this project forward. And it doesn't completely derail us. So it makes our plans just that much smarter and flexible to all the different variables that we face.
That sounds like a daunting challenge. You know, I've seen CIPs that are put together, you know, submitted to the regulatory body or what have you, and then while they're used, they aren't updated until the next you know time that they need to be updated. And so, kind of, can you talk a little about building in that dynamic aspect to the CIP?
Yeah, I think it requires ownership and passionate staff that are going to use a tool like that and that are going to keep it up to date. So it does require some time investment from the people who are managing it. But I'm kind of hoping, I haven't really seen this yet, but I'm kind of hoping that AI and other tools like that can make using a platform like this much, much easier so that we can just query it and say, hey, this happened. You know, my dream would be to type into an AI platform. My growth projections changed. Can you reprioritize my CIP and then get a picture of what that looks like? We're not there yet. I have not seen anything quite like that. But so for right now, it does take some time to manage it. But when you do, it really can transform how a utility reacts to change in our environment.
What kind of inputs are driving the changes in a dynamic CIP?
I think there's two big ones that I see. Well, maybe three. Resiliency and climate change. Predicting what our climate's going to look like is interesting and challenging. Affordability is another one. And people have a lot that they've got to pay for out there in our communities. The bipartisan infrastructure law that the Biden-Harris administration passed has been transformative. You know, the biggest infrastructure investment since the Clean Water Act, probably. You know, that's made a dent, but it's not enough. So affordability is a big thing to look at. And then newly regulated or emerging contaminants. As we find more things that we want to remove from water to make it cleaner, like PFAS and lead and copper, things like that, all of that costs a lot of money as well. So, you know, ties back to that affordability piece. But those are the things that are really hard to fully predict. At what level are we going to regulate? At what level are we going to see water supply shortage and need to plan for different water supply? And how much is our community going to realistically be able to pay for relative to everything else they've got to afford?
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk about one water, and it seems to me that one water is an approach that optimizes, or at least has the goal of optimizing the use of water resources and water infrastructure. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, one water's been around for a little bit. It's by no means am I groundbreaking anything here, but I think one water ties back to this concept of how we value water, which is sort of the crux of your podcast here. That I don't think we value water enough as a society. There are places where it is so highly valued, but especially here in the U.S., it's relatively, for a lot of people, a given that you turn on the tap, the water comes out, you flush the toilet, it goes away. And it's hard for us to see and understand the cost of water. It's even harder for us to see and understand how things like rainfall and snowpack and stormwater affect the supply and availability of that water. So I think one of the value benefits of a one water approach is in just educating how we think about the water cycle so that people can understand a little bit more how things in the environment impact the cost and the availability and the quality of the water that they use every day. And then, of course, you know, going back to this concept of economics and scarcity, it's all about doing more with less, thinking systemically about the entire water life cycle, that a droplet of water, you know, exists and it goes through a waste stream, it goes into the environment, it is treated, it is drank, it is evaporated, condensed, and precipitated into the environment. This one droplet of water continues to exist out there. And so everything is tied together. What we do in drinking water to treat corrosion, if we add orthophosphate to treat corrosion, that's going to show up as phosphorus in our waste stream and cause harmful algal blooms down the road in Puget Sound. So we can't do one thing without considering the entire water life cycle. So ultimately, what I think this concept of one water is pushing us as engineers to do is get creative with how we think about designing solutions that look at the whole life cycle, that look systemically, that look programmatically at water infrastructure.
I love what you're saying. Do you have some examples maybe that, can showcase kind of that, that approach?
You know, California is, an interesting water story because they, you know, as long as I can remember in my career, California was synonymous with drought. And that went so far as to affect our ability to pay for wastewater infrastructure because wastewater rates were tied to drinking water. Fast forward to, you know, the last couple of years where we've seen some of the craziest storms in California in my lifetime and have never thought about our need to have infrastructure available to capture that stormwater so that we can use it, treat it, put it back into the system, and it can create resiliency. That requires us to think way outside of the traditional box that we did 50 years ago. It's requiring us to plan for unknown events, optimize how much we can collect, where it goes, who pays for it, all of these big questions. So, you know, when I think of resilient One Water solutions, I'm always thinking about how can we make California more drought resistant by using stormwater that falls, capture, collect it, treat it, put it into the system, and then ideally start to work on direct potable reuse or indirect potable reuse there where we have more of that. And we put it back into the system after it's in the waste stream. So I, you know, I always think One Water, I immediately, my brain just jumps California.
Yeah. Yeah. Los Angeles announced a few years ago that they were going to engage in stormwater capture, right? I mean, so that's,
kind of,
so have you been keeping up on that? Where's the status of that?
You know, I wish I could say I had. I don't know the status of that off the top of my head. I know that there's been some really interesting white papers that I would encourage your listeners to go look at on how they are using their collection system to capture stormwater during those peak rainflow events. But you know what? The specifics of that, it's been a while since I've looked at it. No worries.
I know that was kind of off the cuff there. So when a community is wanting to implement One Water approaches, you know, what kind of rises to the top? You know, where can they get the most bang for their buck on a One Water approach in terms of their spending?
That's a good question. I don't know that the industry agrees on where to get the most bang for your buck in infrastructure spending and in any type of infrastructure. But for me personally, I think that we can't ignore the importance of investing in water quality. And, you know, we've seen what happens when we don't do that in Flint, in Jacksonville, in places that have just had really, really rough goes of it with water quality. And I think that, you know, if you were to ask me what's the number one thing I think we should invest in, it's making sure that no child or parent ever has to worry about their access to safe, clean drinking water. To me, that's where we can do better. I know that's not really necessarily a quote unquote One Water solution, but water quality just right now is super top of mind, making sure that we are providing that to people across the whole country.
Yeah. So that brings an interesting point. So I'm thinking in my mind, you know, large system versus medium system versus small system. We all know we've heard that the statistics a million times. There's over 50,000 public water supplies in the U.S. Most of those are very small systems. And those are the systems that struggle the most. I'm not going to say it's categorical, but the smaller systems struggle the most with water quality. So are there differences in a One Water approach between large, medium, small, or is there some other metric I should be looking at here?
You know, I think there are. I think both or all three of those still struggle with affordability. But the bigger systems have economies of scale that are generated in their infrastructure. They have a bigger rate base to lean on to pay for that. And while there are pockets of affordability issues in large cities, they've, you know, by and large, been able to tackle a lot of the bigger infrastructure projects. When we have regulations like the lead and copper rule come out, smaller rural communities don't necessarily always have the organizational infrastructure to respond to that, let alone the financial. You know, I look at a really cool project that we're doing in Colorado right now for the Colorado Department of Public Health. And they brought us in to help bring up to 900 small community water systems into compliance with the lead and copper rule, where we're getting to help them develop their inventory of all of these assets and then plan out compliance and be a communicator to the public about these plans and provide access to information for them on where lead and copper is in the system. And so this has been a really cool approach because it aggregated all of these systems together at a state level and created the economies of scale that they wouldn't have otherwise. So it made having that service and access to some really cool big picture programmatic tools much easier for these communities. And so I got to give credit to a colleague of mine, Josh, who's really taken this model and thought, if we can do this type of aggregation for a bunch of different issues that small systems face, that's how we can do more with less. That's how we can bring a high, high level of service and access to a lot of cool tools to these smaller systems that otherwise wouldn't have the organizational infrastructure or maybe wouldn't have the financial ability to do all of that.
So that's very interesting. Now, let me ask you this. Is the state paying for that aggregation or are all the member systems paying some sort of pro rata share to,
you know, that's a good question. And I don't know off the top of my head. I know our contract is with the state, but there may be things behind the scenes that kind of that they do with those member agencies. I'm not 100% sure. I think there are opportunities for that, you know, that to be something that states and the industry looks at is how to make that more prevalent and more of a reality and make it work regardless of how you pay for it.
Yeah. What are some other, because I've seen communities like band together on, for example, like purchasing road salt for the winter and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a government cooperative, so to speak, that where they do some sort of joint procurement. What are the other kind of low hanging fruit for that joint procurement type of model that you described for the lead and copper rule compliance?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me this question because I get to talk about the favorite project that I'm working on right now. And I've spent a lot of time talking about some of the meatier and weightier issues that we're dealing with as an industry in water quality. But I have seen a really cool example of governments coming together to regionalize water facilities to spur economic development. And so the amount of federal funding to bring jobs from overseas back into the U.S. for manufacturing, I'm thinking of things like chips and solar and all sorts of other technology that goes way over my head. But one of the big challenges of doing that is where are they going to get their water? And they require a high degree of advanced water treatment. And we want to do it sustainably, where we're building zero liquid discharge facilities for these industrial manufacturers so that we're not drawing millions of gallons a day out of a lot of drought prone areas because land is cheap out in the desert. So what's been really cool, and I can't say the state because it's all confidential, but I'm working with the state out in the Southwest on solving this challenge. And where the governments are coming together and saying, we'll provide regional water facilities so that jobs are brought to these cities and towns and everyone can benefit. And we're going to do it sustainably so that we're not harming the environment or drawing more than than is needed out. So that's been a really refreshing and cool thing to see, because I can't think of a lot of projects where we've had that type of collaboration for the purpose of managing water well and creating jobs.
So that's a very interesting project, because you've kind of struck gold there, because it is so difficult to overcome the political differences, or not necessarily differences, but the political issues when trying to get governments to collaborate. Because in my experience, they rarely trust one another. They'd rather keep the job growth, for example, within their own boundaries. It's really difficult to overcome the politics. Do you have any insights? I mean, I know it's a confidential project, but do you have any insights on how those political obstacles were overcome?
I think it's when you have people who at the staff level and some political will as well, that are so passionate about this to fight for what's needed, and to realize that to get there, we're going to have to solve problems, we're going to have to negotiate, we're going to have to think outside the box and look at the ways in which the private sector can help, because there is, you know, there sometimes is a chicken and egg problem of how do we build this before we have people using it. So it's because the problems aren't super easily solved. I think it's pushed policymakers to get creative and to see the need to be creative. But gosh, I feel you. It is a very politically tense world out there. Regardless of how things go, I really hope that we don't slow our roll on investing in infrastructure, because we've made so many strides over the last couple of years, and we just can't roll it back, because this water infrastructure is so needed.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I think that's important from a political perspective is too often communities don't build the foundation, they don't build the relationships before the collaboration is needed. If you work on the collaboration before it's actually needed, you have that base and that level of trust, that reservoir of trust, if I can use a water metaphor, to go out and collaborate better and trust one another. And I think, to me, and the problem with that is it just takes a lot of work and everyone's really busy. And, you know, if it's not flashing red, a lot of decision makers or politicians are not going to address it until, you know, because they're putting out fires constantly. So,
yeah, you're so right. It sounds like you've gone through plenty of mediation exercises in your role as a lawyer and seen that need for trust.
Yeah. Just a few, you know. So you've talked a lot about the need for infrastructure and how all the good has come of the recent infrastructure investments. Do you have some examples of how, for example, the bipartisan infrastructure law funds have been put to work in the water space?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it has flown through EPA's WIFIA program, which is the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, that provides low interest loans to communities. And we're seeing more capacity there, more investment in things like lead and copper. I think Chicago got a big WIFIA award for lead and copper. Seen stuff here in King County to address water quality and treatment infrastructure concerns. So they're doing a good job of looking across the entire board. They're not just focused on the sexiest water treatment stuff, the most innovative. They're recognizing that this money is also needed to keep the investment flowing into basic things like pipes. So that's been really good. One of the things I think that is most advantageous about that program is how creatively they allow you to structure the debt. And the fact that they allow you to wait until a few years after construction is complete to begin your repayment. That is so powerful because it allows us to minimize rate shock, and smoothing rates over time is a tool in our toolbox that keeps community will for paying for these things at a good level, because nobody wants their rates to have to skyrocket 20%. And that's when we start to get the struggles in the community to pay for it, and people are not interested in their rates going that high. And so if we're able to spread that out and smooth it over time, it is so powerful to keep that will alive. So I think what they're doing with Wyffia is amazing, and I hope that it just continues to expand and expand and expand. I've written and helped communities secure about 600 million of that money, and the tens of millions that we save because the interest rate is low, that's real money to people. That is a real rate savings that people can feel. And so the more we have that, just, I think, the better.
Yeah. You're singing from my sheet of music in terms of the rate issue. Regular small increases will prevent a lot of problems. It'll take care of deferred maintenance. It'll help mitigate deferred maintenance. I'm not going to say that it'll eliminate it, but
I think you're right. That's deferred maintenance is a challenge, and it's something that's gotten us to where we are today. Of we probably should have been investing at a much higher rate than we were over the last 30 years.
Absolutely.
And so we're used to water rates being what they are. We don't, like, going back to this concept of value, we don't really as a society understand just how valuable this stuff is. And when your water rate is the same as your iPhone bill, and people don't blink at paying the iPhone bill, but go, oh my gosh, my utility bills are so high. And I know, because I live in Seattle and they're really high. And I've said this before, but then I have to remind myself, this infrastructure is not cheap, and it's so needed and so important for us to have a thriving and healthy society that we shouldn't even blink at that.
Amen. Amen. well said, Alex. So real quick, could you give us kind of a, in your view, what's your peek ahead at some of the emerging issues and what you see for the water infrastructure sector coming up?
Yeah. My dad gets to go to DC every year and present the ACEC report card on dams. And we're not doing so hot in our ACEC report card on infrastructure. I would love to see us move the needle on that and get from a D, or I think overall we've been a C-, up into a passing grade. But that aside, there's a couple of things that immediately come to mind that the industry should focus on, in my opinion. One is a shortage of engineers and people in high school and college that see a really strong and exciting career path. It's really hard. Living in Seattle, it's hard for us to compete with tech for talent. And there just aren't enough people going into this field to keep up with the enormous amount of work we have. One of the things that we can do is to better capture the value of this infrastructure so that we can work with our clients and as a community to be able to pay competitive salaries for people working in this industry. I think it's a good, stable job to have. We have not nearly had the ups and downs that other industries have had. But I remember when I started, and my friends were at Microsoft making way more. And so I really am passionate about trying to make sure that people understand the value that our engineers are providing so that we can retain them. I also am super passionate about encouraging more women to go into engineering, more people of color to go into engineering. This has been a very white male dominated field for a long time. And when I started at WSP, I said, we're going to change what it means to be a high growth oriented team. We're going to be the most diverse team in the industry. And so I think that gives us a unique look at challenges that communities are facing. I think it gives us the most creative ideas out there. But I encourage everyone to just, again, think outside the box and really go talk to some high schoolers and tell them why a career in engineering is going to be just so cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Alex, you've been absolutely phenomenal today. Really appreciated your perspective on things, how you've kind of cast the industry and kind of what your insights are. Do you have a leave behind message?
That's such a good question. Dave, it's been just wonderful talking with you. I feel like I could go for another hour or more even on these topics. My leave behind message is just for people to continue to look for value in these infrastructure investments that we're making, to think outside the box, think creatively, and celebrate the emerging talent that is coming into this industry, and never stop losing that passion for what I think is just one of the most precious resources we have, which is water.
Great. Well, Alex, again, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. For those who want to find out more about you and your work, where can they go to get that information?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Alex Shannon, or go to WSP.com, and I'm on our water page there.
Awesome. Again, thanks so much, Alex. We'll talk to you soon. Appreciate all your time. We'll talk. Bye. Absolutely tremendous interview by Alex. Loved viewing water through the different lenses that he applied. Thank you again, Alex, for sharing your insights and perspectives. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast and click the first link that comes up. That's our home on the web that we get through Bluefield Research. And as longtime listeners know, Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliates. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, Bluefield gives us a home on the web. Well, you can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that aforementioned landing page as well. Thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day and have a great holiday season. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Water Works Association. And this show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And again, thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water.